We're now going to resume with this installment of Radio Free America number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. And what we're doing, as I've indicated a number of times this evening, is we're going to take a look, we are taking a look, at the historical development of the explicitly fascist milieu that we've looked at in our first two installments. That milieu came into ascendance with the assassination of President Kennedy, not only in the United States, but as we shall see in weeks to come, the world as a whole. But in order to understand how this came into being, we are going to be going back to the Second World War itself. Now, in the radio broadcast, High Command, that you heard, and granted, it may have sounded a trifle corny due to the aesthetics of 1940s radio, there were some very, very important political truths expressed, and one of the most important of those truths is that the German political vision, the vision not only of the German General Staff and the industrialists that they represented, but also the vision of the Nazi Party, the political vision went way beyond simply the waging of one war. On the contrary, their plans for ascendance on the world stage were based on a broad concept of historical and political operation, one which encompassed the successful integration of the actions, both military and political, of decades. And once again, I want to reiterate the observation of Prussian military theoretician von Clausewitz, who observed that war was the continuation of politics or policy by other means. You'll see it translated both ways. Well, the reverse is true also. Politics is the continuation of war by other means, and in the Cold War, that is what we have seen. We're going to be looking at, for much of the broadcast this evening, a little-known but very, very important book that was written in 1944, the same year that you heard that broadcast from. The book is called The Nazis Go Underground, and it was authored by Kurt Ries, last name R-I-E-S-S. The book, as I said, was copyrighted in hardcover by, or it was published, I should say, in 1944, copyrighted in hardcover by Doubleday, Duran and Company of New York City. Kurt Ries was a very important and very brilliant anti-fascist writer whose works, like those of so many of his contemporaries, were submerged in the McCarthy period in the early 1950s. And we're going to be taking a look at the McCarthy period, how it grew up, and the implications of that later on in this archive program. Among Kurt Ries's other books were Total Espionage, Underground Europe, The Self-Betrayed, and The Invasion of Germany. A very important writer, but one whose works tragically have not survived to the extent that they deserve to survive. And in The Nazis Go Underground, Kurt Ries details how the German General Staff had a broad-based concept of conquest, one which encompassed the successful actions of decades, and a program which necessitated the integration of both political and military action. Kurt Ries writes in The Nazis Go Underground, and again, he's speaking 1944, "Even today, while World War II is still being fought, the more realistic German generals are discussing what must be done to prepare a new war. In November of 1943, the Algerian weekly Combat, C-O-M-B-A-T, published a few remarks of these generals. General Otto von Stülpnagel even composed a lengthy memorandum on the war to come." This was obviously before World War II. That man's last name, S-T-U-E-L-P-N-A-G-E-L. He wrote, quote, "What does a provisional defeat matter to us if, because of the destruction of manpower and materiel which we will have been able to inflict on our enemies and neighboring territories, we have obtained a margin of economic and demographic superiority greater than before 1939. I would interject that as a result of the Second World War, even though Germany was formally militarily defeated, it had suffered far less damage to its heavy industry than its neighbors and did not experience the demographic reduction, the reduction in population, that many of the countries which fell under its fell before its armies did. Continuing, "The conquest of the world will require numerous stages, but the essential is that the end of each stage brings us an economic and industrial potential greater than that of our enemies. With the war booty which we have accumulated, the enfeebling of two generations of the manpower, the destruction of the industries of our neighbors, and that which we can save of our own, we shall be better placed to conquer in 25 years than we were in 1939. The interval of 25 years is a limited interval, for that is the time which will be required for Russia to repair the destruction we have visited on her. Now, obviously, this was during the war. I correct myself. Continuing. That last sentence again. The interval of 25 years is a limited interval, for that is the time which will be required for Russia to repair the destruction we have visited on her. We do not have to fear peace conditions analogous to those which we have imposed, because our adversaries will always be divided and disunited. Our enemies recognize already that the 1920 formula, Germany will pay, unquote, lacked sense and worth. We will furnish them some brigades of workers, we will restore some art objects or out-of-date machines, and we can always say that those which we do not restore were destroyed by enemy bombardments. We should immediately prepare as camouflage a list of such objects destroyed by Anglo-American bombs. Marshal von Rundstedt made a speech in the War Academy in Berlin in which he argued along much the same line. Quote, "The destruction of our neighboring people and their riches is indispensable to our victory. One of the great mistakes of 1918 was to spare the civil life of the enemy countries, for it is necessary for us Germans to be always at least double the number of peoples of contiguous countries. We are therefore obliged to destroy at least a third of their inhabitants. The only means is organized underfeeding, which in this case is better than machine guns." I would also note, too, a fact which has largely been overlooked, is that at the end of the Second World War, German heavy industry, which as we've looked at in the first two Radio Free America shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika and others, was deeply involved with American industry and finance. German heavy industry was largely intact at the end of the Second World War. Some plants had been bombed, and some of those plants were then paid for by or the multinational corporations that owned them were compensated by the American government. But it should be noted that the German economy in the Second World War was crippled as a result of Allied air forces knocking out two basic elements, knocking out rolling stock and road traffic. Allied fighter bombers, chiefly American, were able to interdict both German rail and road traffic to an enormous extent, thereby preventing key war materiel from reaching the armies at the front. And beyond that, fuel, without which no transportation can take place, the German fuel-making capacity was interdicted as well. The decisive air battle vis-à-vis German industry in the Second World War was what has become known as the Battle of Leuna. That's spelled L-E-U-N-A, I'm not sure of the pronunciation. But the enormous IG Farben synthetic fuel processing plant at Leuna was repeatedly attacked by the U.S. 8th Army Air Force. Even though the Germans themselves were able to keep the plant in operation, the damage was so extensive that in order to keep this vital fuel synthesizing facility open, the Germans had to cannibalize so many of their other gasoline synthesizing plants oil synthesizing plants that their capacity to synthesize oil became simply inadequate for their war needs. I would note that as I documented in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the hydrogenation process by which Germany was able to synthesize oil from coal was developed by the Germans, and the Standard IG Agreement of 1929 provided them with the capital to compensate them for that particular production. It also guaranteed that the Germans would be able to use the hydrogenation process to manufacture fuel in Germany only, thereby protecting Standard Oil of New Jersey's worldwide operations from the potential commercial threat of synthesized oil. It should also be noted again that IG Farben acquired 2% of Standard of New Jersey's stock, thereby becoming the second largest holder in Standard Oil of New Jersey behind the Rockefeller family. IG Farben, of course, the massive German chemical and fuel cartel of the Second World War, the backbone of Nazi war production. But again, it should be noted that German heavy industry was largely intact at the end of the war. Some plants were destroyed, but the German economy, the German war economy, was brought to a halt by interdicting the capacity to transport manufactured goods to the armies at the front. Again, rail and road traffic were interdicted by Allied fighter bombers, and their fuel-making capacity was neutralized by strategic bombardment, the Battle of Leuna being the key element in that particular campaign. So the rebuilding of German industry was relatively easy at the end of the war, and as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, U.S. industry and finance, the same industrialists and financiers that had collaborated with the Third Reich, and many of those industrialists and financiers were ardently pro-fascist, others were simply interested in profits. They saw to it that the same industrial and financial concerns which backed Hitler were put back in power at the end of World War II. Next, when we're going to stick with The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Ries, what we're going to look at now is how the German General Staff began planning for defeat. They had seen their military defeat coming in October of 1941, and they formally met to begin making plans for that defeat on December 9th, 1941, 2 days after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, it should be noted in this regard that the German General Staff's plans to defeat the Soviet Union called for a blitzkrieg. It called for lightning war. The Germans had no capacity to winter, or had not envisioned that they would have to winter inside of the Soviet Union. The German armies they met unexpected resistance. They were not able to keep to their timetable. By October 15th of 1941, the Germans realized that they may very well lose the war. And by December 9th of 1941, with Japan having attacked the United States, and with the United States inevitably going to enter the war against Germany, the German generals realized that they were going to lose World War II. At this point, the Red Army had begun a counteroffensive before Moscow against the German armies, and beyond that, from a strategic standpoint, the Germans stood to fight China, which was on the Allied side, the most populous nation in the world, the Soviet Union, which was the second most populous independent nation of the world and a major manufacturing power. India, it should be noted, now an independent country and the second most populous nation on earth, was part of the British Empire, which obviously was also fighting the Axis powers. The Soviet Union, obviously, was fighting against the Axis. And on December 7th, 1941, the United States, the third most populous independent country in the world and an enormous manufacturing power, came into the war, or its entry into the war on the side of the Allies was made inevitable. So the Germans, in December of 1941, saw themselves fighting the combined population and manufacturing capacity of the British Empire, including India. The Axis powers had to fight China, the most populous nation on Earth, the Soviet Union, the second most populous independent nation, and a major manufacturing power, and the United States, the third most populous nation and an enormous manufacturing power. The Germans realized that they were going to lose, and it's worth noting that by December, again, of 1941, the German generals were beginning to plan for a temporary defeat, but to reconstitute for the broad-based conquest, which was outlined in the speeches or in the statements of Generals von Stupnagel and von Rundstedt, which I outlined above, or which I read above. Now, we're going to take a look at General Werner von Brauchitsch, the general whom you heard dramatized in that particular radio show. That's the von Brauchitsch, which we see here. By the way, that's his last name, Brauchitsch. Kurt Ries writes, von Brauchitsch was not a general of great vision, but he was a man who could judge a military situation when he saw one. And he could retain his judgment even in the face of the impressive advances the German army had made in Russia during the first 4 months. He had a good memory. He remembered the spectacular advances of General von Kluck's First Army in August of 1914. That's K-L-U-C-K. The young Brauchitsch had been a liaison officer in that army. He remembered in what an unbelievably short time the Germans had rushed to the Marne and the Ourcq. That's M-A-R-N-E and capital O-U-R-C-Q. And then came the defeat at the Marne, and the war was lost, although it took 4 more years to establish this accomplished fact. Brauchitsch could not be deceived by impressive partial successes. He knew that the timetable for the conquest of the Soviet Union had not been kept, that the Russian army had by no means been crushed, that it had by no means been prevented from deploying. All of which meant that the war would not be over before the Russian winter would set in. And Brauchitsch knew that the German army was not equipped to spend a Russian winter fighting. Therefore, Brauchitsch was in favor of a retreat. On October 15th, now this is 1941, he had called a meeting of his outstanding generals to talk things over. However, the meeting did not develop according to his expectations. Hitler dropped in unexpectedly. The generals all agreed with von Brauchitsch. They were unanimous in their belief that the offensive should be discontinued in the face of the ever-increasing strength of the Russian army and the approaching winter. Field Marshal von Bock, B-O-C-K, even proposed a withdrawal of some 200 miles. Hitler objected violently. He had no intention of going back. He had every intention of going on with the war and of attacking a handful of other countries in the near future. He did not want to lose his newly acquired prestige as a military genius. A heated discussion ensued, and harsh words were exchanged between some of the generals, particularly Herr von Bock and Hitler's private advisors whom he had brought along. But nothing definite was decided upon. 6 weeks later, Brauchitsch knew that he had been right. The Russian army had begun its first counteroffensive. The winter in Russia was now a dead certainty. On top of it all, on December 7th, Japan had declared war on the United States, and it was only a question of days, perhaps hours, till Germany and America would be at war too. Such was the situation when Brauchitsch met his generals once more on December 9th, 1941. That date may become historic, for it was on this day that the generals admitted quite openly to each other that the war could no longer be won. Or as one of them put it, quote, the Third Reich has lost the war, unquote. And the others said it in other words, all of them, von Bock, von Rundstedt, von Liebt, L-E-E-B, von Kleist, K-L-E-I-S-T, von Manstein, M-A-N-N-S-T-E-I-N, and the chief of staff, General Halder, H-A-L-D-E-R. It was then that Brauchitsch decided to resign as commander-in-chief, and that the others decided to decline to take over his job, and with it the responsibility for the war if the Führer should offer it to them. All of which meant that the generals, although well aware that the war was lost for Germany, had every intention of surviving it themselves. The generals intended to save themselves till after the war, because thus, and only thus, could they hope to save the army, or what was the same thing, to maintain conditions favorable to a rebuilding of the army. It was on this December 9th, 1941, that they decided on the course they should take. They knew that there was ample time to accomplish their plan before the final defeat, but they did not intend to be surprised as they had been surprised in 1918. What could they do? What kind of preparations could they make? They could demonstrate to Germany and to the world at large that they had nothing to do with the planning of this war, that they could not be blamed for anything except for having done their duty as soldiers. They were worlds apart from that man Hitler, who was the only person to be blamed. I would interject at this point, too, that one of the things which permitted, to a large extent, the survival of elements of the Third Reich after the formal defeat of Nazi Germany was what is known as the Führerprinzip, the notion that at the top, sort of the top of a pyramid, was Hitler and that everyone else was simply following orders. This permitted the rationalization of no moral guilt for those who had collaborated with Hitler. It was a rationale which the Allies buyed to a considerable extent. A few of the top Nazis were executed, a few were jailed. Most of them were simply either given a wrist slap or, as in the case of many of the SS intelligence and military people, incorporated not only into the Galen organization but through that into the U.S. national security establishment and into a primary position of power in the post-World War II world, Galen we will come to next week. It should be noted that the German army did indeed begin to make plans to rebuild, and this as early as March of 1942, continuing with The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Reiss. Some of them, including von Rundstedt and von Bock, met again on March 10, 1942, in the Army Ministry in Berlin. They decided to create certain cadre, or organizations, most necessary to rebuilding the army in the future. This preparatory work was to be done through Department A4, a branch of the Auslandsabteilung of the War Ministry, and the Demobilization Department of the General Staff. The work in Department A4 was entrusted to Major General Werner Graberg, G-R-A-B-E-R-G, while that in the Demobilization Department was handed over to Colonel Richard Delius, D-E-L-I-U-S. In addition to those two men, they called upon General George Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S, one of Goering's most intimate collaborators who had a post in the Ministry of Economics. Thomas, of whom it had been said repeatedly that he had resigned, was considered one of the most brilliant minds dealing with economic problems in Germany. So indeed, and by the way, I would emphasize something I did not mention as we began moving into the Kurt Reiss book, This book is in large measure based not only on journalistic accounts, but also intelligence accounts from underground organizations within Europe as the Allies advanced. Just as the German generals had envisioned their own defeat as early as December of 41, even October, the Nazi Party itself, although lagging somewhat behind the German generals, the Nazi Party itself, after the Battle of Stalingrad, which concluded in February of 1943, began making concerted plans to go underground and to prepare for the post-World War II political realities, and once again to continue to proceed with the war, continuation of politics as war by other means. Turning around what von Clausewitz said. Of the Nazi Party's plans to go underground, which were formally put into effect on May 16th of 1943, Kurt Reiss writes as follows. The Nazis went underground on May 16th, 1943. Before that day, there had been many weeks of preliminary and preparatory work, work done mainly inside the so-called Gestapo building in the Prinz Albrechtstrasse, Berlin, where Himmler had his headquarters on the second floor. But on May 16th, the real work began. On that day, those who were in charge of it moved to a spacious house, almost a little chateau, at 11 Königsallee in Berlin, Grunewald. That's K-O-E-N-I-G-S-A-L-L-E. Grunewald is G-R-U-N-E-W-A-L-D. Continuing. The whole estate, which had once belonged to a Jewish banker and had been taken over by the Nazis before the outbreak of the war, comprised more than a square mile. The rebuilt house contained large rooms on the first floor and a number of small offices on the second floor. The left wing of the main building was occupied by General Werner Heißmeier of the SS and his staff, the right wing by General Fritz Kaltenbrunner of the SS. Heißmeier, H-E-I-S-S-M-E-Y-E-R, Kaltenbrunner, K-A-L-T-E-N-B-R-U-N-N-E-R. In the large, well-kept garden that surrounded the house, some of the old trees had been cut off to make room for small office bungalows. The archives were stored in a bomb-proof cellar. I quote from a report, quote, "It was the intelligence department of the Gestapo which moved to 11 Königsallee on May 15th and 16th. From May 16th on, the intelligence department of the Gestapo was split into two parts. About half of the officials went on as usual in the Prinz Albrechtstrasse. The rest worked in Königsallee under Heißmeier and Kaltenbrunner. Albrechtstrasse is A-L-B-R-E-C-H-T-S-T-R-A-S-S-E. Continuing. Strange orders began to issue from 11 Königsallee during the following weeks, most of them unintelligible to those who received them. It was, for instance, decreed that certain units within a certain government department should be dissolved and that other new units should be formed in other departments. Minor officials were suddenly transferred into departments for which they had never worked. From September of 1943 on, these strange orders increased. Some important departments were suddenly dissolved or completely organized, reorganized, or merged with other departments. All these orders were signed by Heinrich Himmler, who had by then become General Plenipotentiary of the Reich. At 11 Königsallee, everyone worked feverishly. They had better means for preparing to go underground than any other potential underground movement in the entire previous history of the world." That last sentence again, because it's a key one. "They had better means for preparing to go underground than any other potential underground movement in the entire previous history of the world. They had all the machinery of the well-organized Nazi state, and they had a great deal of time to prepare everything. They worked very hard, but they did nothing hastily, left nothing to chance. Everything was thought through thoroughly and logically and organized to the last detail. Himmler planned with the utmost coolness. He chose for the work only the best qualified experts, the best qualified, that is, in matters of underground work. What exactly does it mean to go underground? It means that a person, or a number of persons, a unit, a force, an idea, a movement that had been visible before, becomes invisible. It is no longer represented to the outside world. It has become anonymous. Its existence is known only by the effects of its actions. To go underground is for a single person, and even more so for a large number of persons, first of all, a question of organization. the Nazis had always been very fond of and very good at organization. And as we're going to see, the principal element involved in the underground transition of the German National Socialist Workers Party, the NSDAP, the Nazi Party, was to lie with the SS and the Gestapo of Heinrich Himmler, and as we will see next week, that SS and that Gestapo played a critical role in the Gehlen organization, but when it was part of the U.S. intelligence apparatus and when it jumped to Germany. Of the SS and the Gestapo and its pivotal role in the coming Nazi underground movement, and in particular of Heinrich Himmler's deep study of the history of underground movements, Kurt Ries writes as follows in The Nazis Go Underground. The preparatory work, then, had to be centralized. But there was some question as to where the centralization should be done. Should it be entrusted to one of Bormann's organizations, the Verbindungsstab, the liaison staff of the Führer, for instance, the machinery for which had been built by Hess and in which key men of all party and state organizations were represented? The Verbindungsstab is Verbindungsstab. Continuing. Some of the Nazis were of the opinion that this might be an excellent idea. However, by the end of April, or at the latest by the beginning of May of 1943, the Gestapo, that is one of Himmler's organizations, was definitely put in charge of the entire preparatory work for the Nazi underground after the war. There were several reasons for this move. Perhaps one of the main reasons was that Himmler, by dint of constantly simplifying his organization and increasing its efficiency, had brought it to such a state of perfection that by now the Gestapo had become by far the best organized machine within the Third Reich, a fact which would facilitate the work considerably, while Bormann had hardly changed the much less streamlined organizations which Hess had left him. It was probably the hope that Himmler's great talent in organizing would work miracles which finally got him the job. But perhaps it was also the fact that Himmler wanted it, and the police minister could be strangely persistent when he wanted something for himself. The world knows a great deal about Heinrich Himmler, and still, it knows very little. He has chiefly been known all over the world, and particularly inside Germany and the occupied countries, as the cruel police chief of the Third Reich. So much so that Dr. Goebbels decided by the end of 1943 to distribute 4 million picture postcards showing a smiling Himmler talking to children in order to prove that he is a human being, even as you and I. But there are many sides to Himmler of which very few people have ever heard. Scarcely more than a few dozen men, for instance, have ever known anything about Himmler the scholar. The evidence of his particular study was probably destroyed on November 23, 1943, when British bombs laid in ruins the building in the Prinz Albrechtstrasse. Himmler's rooms contained a small but extremely specialized private library consisting entirely of books dealing with the subject of underground movements. There were volumes on the intrigues of the Bourbons since 1789, on the Bonaparte movement after 1815, on what happened in Prussia between 1806 and 1812. There were Kotzebue's works on the history of German orders, the writing of Lenin and Trotsky on the organization of underground movements, and those of Dzerzhinsky, the first efficient police organizer of the Bolsheviks, as well as books on the Ku Klux Klan, the Irish revolutionary movements, the German Free Corps, and FEMA organizations of the early 1920s, etc. Spellings, by the way, Kotzebue is K-O-T-Z-E-B-U-E. Dzerzhinsky is D-J-E-R-S-H-I-N-S-K-Y. Continuing. That was what Heinrich Himmler had been interested in for a long time. Underground movements of revolutionary character, underground movements of forces, and personalities who had been deprived of power and wanted to stage a comeback. All these books most undoubtedly have influenced Himmler, and thus, they will influence the future strategy of the Nazi underground. Germans are fond of thinking and acting in historical parallels. So again, one of the central points of the last couple of passages, remember now, the German General Staff making plans for their post-World War II revival on December 9th. 1941, the Nazi Party itself was going underground by May 16th of 1943, and that coming underground movement to have been built around and executed by the Gestapo and SS. I would note, too, that what that means is for the last 2 years of World War II, The Third Reich was fighting what is known in military terms as a rear guard action. They were conducting a military defense for the purposes of effecting an orderly and successful retreat so that they might fight again. Only, obviously, with the advent of nuclear weapons, the possibility of open frontal warfare became obsolete. However, once again, politics is the continuation of war by other means, as we pervert slightly von Clausewitz, and that is what the Third Reich, in particular in the person of the Galen organization, was able to do. We will come to that next week. One of the most important methodological and theoretical considerations to understand as we begin looking at this early history of the development of the historical forces which formed the milieu that we looked at the last 2 weeks, and that milieu came into ascendance in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas on 11-22-63. In understanding how the United States lost the Second World War, one must comprehend that one of the major strategic breakthroughs that the Germans, both the German General Staff and the industrialists whom they represented, and the Nazi Party itself, including the SS and Gestapo, they learned that communism, or the threat of communism slash Bolshevism, could be used in a very effective way to promote and guarantee their own survival and perpetuation. What we're going to look at now is how the German Revolution, which took place at the end of World War I, permitted the German General Staff not only to remain in place, but to successfully perpetuate the German Army. Now, once again, in Radio Free America program number 10, and in a miscellaneous archive show about the FEMA and the origins of the Nazi Party, we dealt with the German Revolution and some of its consequences for the politics that followed. There was in Germany, in particular in Bavaria and some of the Baltic states, during the closing days of World War I, an abortive Marxist revolution, much as had taken place in the former Russian Empire in 1917. Many of the workers and soldiers of Germany revolted and set up workers and soldiers Soviets, or councils, much as the Communist Party in the Soviet Union had done. Only the difference was that in Germany, the revolution was successfully put down, this by the German military, because the socialist government of President Friedrich Ebert, E-B-E-R-T, the first president of the Weimar Republic, was very much afraid of the Bolsheviks, as well as the German industrialists and the very sizable German middle class. So they not only saw to it that the German generals of the German imperial days remained in power, but as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, they set up three military organizations, the Freikorps, or Free Corps, the Einwohnerverein, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande. These organizations, composed of the supposedly demobilized German army, successfully quelled the German Revolution. Adolf Hitler, by the way, infiltrated the German Revolution in Munich as an undercover agent for the political department of the Reichswehr under General von Lossow, and then fingered the leaders of the revolution after the German army took over Munich. They were then promptly shot. These organizations, the Freikorps, the Einwohnerverein, and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, after the expiration of their formal terms, they remained intact underground and became known as the so-called Black Reichswehr, or Underground Reichswehr, Underground German Army. They then proceeded to systematically assassinate not only the leaders of the abortive Bolshevik Revolution in Germany, such the various people, Karl von Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. They also proceeded to assassinate the legitimate democratic leadership of Weimar Germany, ranging from socialist to social democratic. People like Foreign Minister Walter von Rathenau, Kurt Eisner, Karl Gereiss, Matthias Erzberger, Gustav Landauer, names history hasn't remembered, they were dispatched by the so-called Black Reichswehr, and that paved the way for Hitler's rise to power, because much of the legitimate political leadership that could have opposed him was dead and buried by 1933, when von Hindenburg appointed him chancellor. It should be noted, though, that as a result of the experience of the German army at the end of World War I, when the socialist president Friedrich Ebert deliberately called on the German generals and enlisted their help to put down the German Revolution, the German General Staff and their industrialists and the Nazi Party, which had its genesis in this period, understood that the threat of communism could be used as a tremendously effective strategic tool in order to effect not only their own survival and perpetuation, but as I will touch on later, the Nazis were able to utilize fear of communism on the part of many industrialists around the world, not only to enlist support, but also to effect the conquest of some of the armies they opposed. The French army, for example, was formally surrendered by Maréchal Pétain, the head of the Vichy collaborationist government, in order to, quote, fight communism. There was a very powerful socialist movement in France prior to World War II, chiefly grouped around the Social Front of Léon Blum, B-L-U-M. Many of the French industrialists and financiers and many of the French officer corps and general staff were more afraid of the socialists in their own country than foreign fascists. There were powerful fascist movements in France, notably the Croix de Fer, or Iron Cross, and the Cagoule, C-A-G-O-U-L-E, a group of French fascists, or a French fascist organization similar in some ways to the Ku Klux Klan. They would conduct assassinations and depredations with hoods over their faces. They were called the, quote, Hooded Ones, or Les Cagoulards, C-A-G-O-U-L-A-R-D-S. The Croix de Fer and La Cagoule actually conducted an abortive fascist coup in 1938. It was put down, similar in some ways to the abortive fascist coup in the United States in 1934 that I discussed in Radio Free America program number 10. But again, the important thing to understand here is that as a result of their experience in the German Revolution at the end of World War I, the German General Staff, the industrialists and financiers who backed them, and the Nazi Party, which had its genesis in this period, came to understand that the fear of communism could be exploited in a most effective way as a tool of conquest. Of the experience of the German General Staff and the German Army, and during the German Revolution, the abortive German Revolution of 1918 and afterward, Kurt Ries writes as follows. On November 9th, 1918, the day of the German Revolution, the gentlemen in the general headquarters on the front were in a highly nervous state. They waited. There was a direct telephone line connecting the general staff with the chancellery in Berlin. They waited. They wondered. Would the man who was now the head of the provisory government of the Republic, the former socialist deputy Friedrich Ebert, E-B-E-R-T, answer the telephone if they called him? In short, would he collaborate with the general staff? Or would he dismiss the men who represented everything the socialists had been fighting against, and who, on top of it all, had lost the war? The chief of the general staff, Wilhelm Groener, G-R-O-E-N-E-R, tried the line, and President Ebert answered. Friedrich Ebert was willing to collaborate with the generals. The socialists wanted the officers to continue in service to protect law and order in Germany. Against whom? Naturally, against the people who had actually believed that a real revolution was on, and that there were and that those who had been directly or indirectly responsible for the war were to be driven from power. After the first conversation, Ebert called back very soon. The man who answered his call was Major Kurt von Schleicher, S-C-H-L-E-I-C-H-E-R. How relieved he must have felt when the bell rang. How relieved General von Hindenburg and his comrades must have felt as well. So there wasn't going to be any revolution. The Social Democrats really didn't want to change so much after all, did they? Major Kurt von Schleicher did not lose much time with such considerations. On the same day, on November 9th, 1918, which has become the historic date of the German Revolution, he began to lay his plans to fight the Republic which he supposedly protected. On this very day, he began to lay his plans to counteract the conditions of the armistice and whatever conditions the peace treaty might impose upon Germany. On this very date, he started the underground movement of the Imperial German Army. It was all very secret. It had to be, because it was a conspiracy not only against the former enemies, but a conspiracy against the very Republic which the officers had sworn to defend, and which incidentally paid the salaries of those officers. A conspiracy in which the Army Ministry of the Republic collaborated gleefully for many years to come. A few disturbing facts leaked out here and there. A few courageous journalists wrote of what was going on behind the scenes. A few convinced Republicans were murdered. That's with a small r, by the way. A few convinced Republicans were murdered, while others were accused of high treason and put into prison. The government, in spite of the fact that it knew better, declared again and again that there was not one iota of truth in the current rumors about the existence of a number of secret armies, a so-called Schwarze Reichswehr, or Black Army, in Germany. Such talk, they said, was all propaganda paid for by France and possibly by Poland. But in spite of these pretenses and excuses, there were such secret armies. As for the official army, the one permitted by the Treaty of Versailles, it never had quite come down to the number of men it was supposed to contain. Schleicher had seen to that, and he had also seen to it that this small army of the New Republic was extremely un-Republican. He had taken care that this army should contain not only nationalist and supranationalist elements, he had taken care that this army should contain only nationalist and supranationalist elements who were waiting impatiently for the day when they could turn against the Republic, against its democratic representatives, and of course later against the whole world to take revenge for the war lost in 1918. Little troops and units began to spring up here and there, which had no connection with the regular army, although the arms they possessed could only have been obtained from the army proper. These troops, so Schleicher explained, should not be disarmed because they protected the country against the communist danger, which he asserted, though without presenting the slightest evidence in proof of his assertion, was growing steadily from day to day. One more time, this slide, these next two sentences are a key. These troops, so Schleicher explained, should not be disarmed because they protected the enemy against the communist danger, which he asserted, though without presenting the slightest evidence in proof of his assertions, was growing steadily from day to day. This, by the way, is something we're going to come back to, this principle of the growing communist danger. We're going to see this in the Cold War period as something that the Pentagon has come to call threat inflation. Continuing, but it was not the communist danger. It was those troops which grew from day to day. During the year 1922, many of them sprang up near the eastern frontier. Their main task was to gather the war material which, according to the Treaty of Versailles, should have been destroyed or surrendered to get it in good shape and to hide it. Some of these groups had fancy names. Most of them were later to be known as the Free Corps. All of them formed what was to become famous as Schwarze Reichswehr. Thus, the following picture presented itself, visible to the world at large there, one more time. Thus, the following picture presented itself, visible to the world at large, there was this relatively small German Reichswehr. Invisible, that is, underground, there was the Schwarze Reichswehr. Both these armies were led and controlled by the same officers. The ultimate control of both was exercised by the Army Ministry of the German Republic. In fact, the illegal Schwarze Reichswehr was just as thoroughly organized as the regular army. In 1922, so-called Erfassungsabteilungen, collecting departments, were created within the Black Reichswehr. That, by the way, is Erfassungsabteilungen. Erfassungsabteilungen. Okay, continuing again. The officers of each military district were thus able to assemble personnel files on all men of military age, precisely what had been forbidden by the Versailles Treaty. And from these files, they were able to build up a certain reserve of the regular Reichswehr, a thing which was also forbidden by the treaty. Within the Department of Operations of Military District 1A was a new department called 1A, a new department called 1AP was created under the somewhat innocent title of Truppenverstärkung, or Troop Reinforcement. The real task of this department was to run the Black Reichswehr and to form the liaison between it and the regular Reichswehr. By the way, Truppenverstärkung is Truppenverstärkung. The leading men in this Truppenverstärkung were von Bock and von Rundstedt, who were later to become the leading generals in World War II. So again, what we are seeing here at the end of World War I is the German army, and beyond that, their industrialists and financiers, as well as the Nazi Party proper, which grew out of the post-World War II underground German military, the Schwarze Reichswehr. They learned that communism, or the threat of communism, could itself be used as a major strategic tool not only for survival and perpetuation of their own interests, but for conquest as well. By the way, I also, this is an entirely speculative note, and I'm simply going to toss this in as something of an aside. One of the things that has really fascinated me about observing the realities of German history, and again, this none of this program should be interpreted as being anti-German. I have tremendous respect for the individual Germans that I've met, and indeed, my program, for quite a while, and for all I know still, was being played on a major Berlin radio station.